Colonel Beaumont James is himself coming over for an hour until the Honourable Maria, because they are fully aware of the importance of this piece of legislation, and we are fortunate that the Honourable James was here initially, you know, and then there was just a slight take over. Well, not take over, that's the wrong notion, but a change of the guard, slight change here within the committee. When you see cameras and all of this, you have to watch your language. But on a more serious note, give us 2 minutes. The Creda copy has just arrived. It's literally hot off the press. So, we all received a Creda copy last night, you will remember. And there were one or two of the so-called technical glitches, am I right? So just give us 2 minutes to set up TVs and, you know, overheads and everything else. Thank you.
I'll try and get one for you. But you can have a B. I'll go and get myself an A now.
Are you sure? Oh, yeah, there's an A here. Thank you.
It was just my concern that it was important to give. In fact, Honourable Salah is here. I just don't see him. He is here. Maybe he's just outside.
Will he talk a lot?
Yeah. Well, he is here, you know. Let's leave it there. But as I say, we have got five members of the ANC and two members from the opposition party. Thank you. All right, on that note, can someone proceed to propose the adoption of the agenda? Honourable Kobasa, seconded by the Honourable McIntosh. Right, so we go where we left off last night. We had just started and done the first page and the changes to the preamble. Do you recall that? Do you recall that? Yes. So now we move on with the B bill in your hand. Clause by clause. Now, you do know I need a mover for each clause. We will stop when you raise your hand, otherwise just say Swanepoel propose, James second, or vice versa. Do you follow what we do? I do need the names on record. Thank you. All right, now we move through to page... Clause 1, which is dealing with definitions. Clause 1, Honourable Kobasa.
Just before we proceed, I just want to clarify one thing that... I think I had been said yesterday when we were discussing that part of the introduction which says to empower the National Consumer Tribunal to declare a credit agreement reckless. I don't know whether it's a figment of my imagination. Did someone raise an issue with an issue about the Consumer Tribunal or court? No.
No.
Advocate Vandermeerba.
Just so there's no confusion, the amendment that we are affecting is that the Act as it is says that currently it is the court that declares the agreement reckless. This amendment is expanding that power to also include the tribunal. So it could be the court or the tribunal that will now be able to declare an agreement as a reckless credit agreement.
So it doesn't remove the power of the court. I hope I'm quite clear there. And I just want to clarify, we've got Ms. Nanyana Mukabane. And your title?
Doctor.
Apart from being doctor, your position would have been
okay,
a better
chief
one.
Director.
Chief director, right. Chief director, I understand, until the DDG comes in, or the DDG Nyetse Ten, the chief director Nyetse Ten, you will be empowered to speak on their behalf. Right. Because they are both at a pharmacy. No. Well, you know, we have to get the facts here. They're either in a hospital, it seems, and a doctor at pharmacy. Right. Well, there we are. That's, I'm talking to the committee. Right. 1. Clause 1, Amendment of Section 1 of Act 34-2005, starting on line 4. A. B, C, D, E. F. I'm mentioning F again because of PDA. G. Any queries, or can we have someone to propose adoption? a little keeping someone on board, which is natural.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, my apologies. We're not having a private meeting. I just want to make sure that that my colleague, Dr. James, has the hottest Creda version which arrived, the 21 of the second. Well, I didn't know that both are that both B47B 2013. Oh, no, well, you should have put B47B.
Okay, got it.
Okay.
I'm fine.
All right, are we all on track?
Yes,
yeah. Yeah,
thanks. Sorry for the confusion.
I guess it was kind of first come, first serve, Honourable Salah. All right, thanks. Any queries before we propose adoption of a clause by someone? Can I have someone to propose adoption? Honourable McIntosh, seconded by Honourable Swanepoel from the ANC. Right. We're now on page 3. Please don't hesitate to raise your hand. Page 3, line 20. Amendment of section 17 of Act 34-2005, clause 2. Section 17 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by A. Remember, the may has been changed to must, if it in my understanding. Recall that, and the reason? B. C. D.
Madam Chair, just a question. I'm sure it's been done, maybe to the DTI, to notify the Registrar of Banks, designated in terms of the Banks Act, of its intention to investigate a bank. Now, I know we haven't had a measure of discomfort from Treasury and also from the FSB, the Financial Services Board, about this law unintentionally possibly entering a field which is not really DTI's. Maybe, Madam Chair, the Department of DTI can tell us that what the position is from the Treasury and FSB side on an amendment like this.
Yes, Madam Chair, on behalf of DTI, maybe may I quickly please clarify that Mr. Nesisende is attending a very pressing engagement, whereas the DDG is actually gone to the pharmacy and will join us later.
Okay.
I'm fairly new in this field, and the good thing is I've got the support of other members. We've been working as a team, so I'll request the NCT to respond to this.
Morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. In the current Act, it only requires the NCR to notify or consult with the Registrar when issuing a compliance notice. Now, this is an extension, and this is what was required or requested by the Registrar of Banks to be included. So, yes, I think it is in order.
You will recall this issue came up when the DDG Mamoniat was here, and the issue raised is, well, what if we won't be a registrar and, you know, new acts and this sort of thing. And the decision between which he indicated they had reached is that, and which we on inquiry from our own advocate was that, if something's being conceptualised, we can't, and it's not even a bill, it's very difficult then to say, well, you know, the Honourable X is proposing this bill, we won't lose because it's a concept that could be coming and is a good idea. It's not reached that bill stage even. So it becomes problematic. So it was agreed that as long as we need at this stage, when this bill goes out, there is a registrar of banks. That's a fact. And they would have to take cognizance of it and perhaps to say in their legislation, where legislation refers to the registrar of banks, it will in future go. That's my understanding. Honourable James.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've not been in the committee's proceedings, but I presume that the Banks Act provides guidelines for what it means to conduct an inquiry into a bank. That the protocols and parameters are contained in the Banks Act. Is that correct? Or is inquiry undefined?
I wouldn't presume for us to comment on the governor, what the governor's up to of the Reserve Bank. You know what I mean? Because this would be in her preserve or the Minister of Finance, National Treasury. But when they were here, and this issue came up both in the presence of the Deputy Governor as well as the DDG. This formulation was put to them and they were happy. This was the idea. Well, we said, what is the status of this? And they said, well, look, it's where we're going. It's the route ahead. But it's not a reality. So right now, we have to refer to the registrar of banks. So that did come up. Is there another inquiry or any comment from our advocate here?
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe just to clarify, the investigation that's referred to here is an investigation in terms of the National Credit Act. So it is when the credit regulator investigates the bank, then the request was you need to, for the systemic risk, etc., notify the registrar of banks. So the registrar of banks is aware that there is an investigation under the National Credit Act.
Thank you very much. I'm satisfied.
In fact, we were very honoured that we did, in fact, have both the Deputy Governor and others here. They did help. So that dealt with that one. I'm just finding my own place now. Mm-hmm. Section 2, that was the inquiry, right. A was clarified that B, C, the D, it was under E where the issue had come up. By the substitution in subsection 5 of paragraph A of the following, may negotiate. Again, the emphasis throughout this bill is now on valid agreements, not just any agreement, valid. So we're up to X. Can we please have somebody, having done that clarification, to propose adoption? Honourable Waiili, seconded by Honourable James. We'd like to get, as it were, Honourable Kwabasi, you know, off sides in right. Can we then move to repeal of section 19? Well, you could always get a refresher on that one, Honourable James, in case you were not here at that particular meeting. 19, 20, 21, 20, and 22 of Act 34, 2005. It is on page 4, I believe, page 3, and then page 4 of the Principal Act. Page 4, you'll see the index there on the Principal Act that looks like page numbers 15 to 20. So, just Honourable James, was that a hand? Or?
No.
Okay. So, it is the repeal of those sections. That's 3. So we do need someone to propose that. It's a clause. Right. Thanks, Honourable McIntosh. Seconded by Honourable Kwabasa. Right. Amendment of Section 23 of Act 34 of 2005. Clause 4. Section 23 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following subsection. The Minister may with the advice and subject to the oversight of the board. This is what has been deleted because we took the structure out and it's replaced by must be responsible for all matters pertaining to the functions of the National Credit Regulator. That's A. All right, members. B. C. I read these matters over because there was a lot of discussion on them. By the addition of the following subsection, the Chief Executive Officer is the accounting authority for the National Credit Regulator, and as such is responsible for. It's all noted there. A, B, C, D, 4. The Chief Executive Officer may assign management. A, B, may appoint a person who is suitably qualified and experienced as a deputy chief executive officer to assist the chief executive officer in carrying out the functions of the national credit, and we have to put in the word regulator. Right? Now, by the deletion of subsection 2, that was, and by the addition. So you can see that this is an addition, a very important one, which we discussed. If we are happy with that, please can we have someone to propose adoption? Honourable McIntosh, seconded by Honourable Kwabasa. We then move on, still on page 4. Amendment of Section 25 of Act 34 of 2005. Clause 5. Section 25 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution of subsection 1 for the words preceding paragraph A of the following words: the Chief Executive Officer or any employee duly authorized by the CEO. That's the addition there. Can we please have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Swanepoel, seconded by Honourable Waihi. Amendment of Section 26 of Act 34, 2005. Clause 6. Section 26 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. A. By the substitution for subsection 4 of the following subsection. To be eligible for appointment or designation as a member of the tribunal. And then you have A of 4A, B, Roman small I, Roman small 2. B. By the addition of the following subsections. 5. A person may not be a member of the tribunal if that person is A, office bearer, I think this is an important one here. I wonder if some of us see this. It's a shift of where we were, perhaps. Very important. Is an office bearer of a party, movement, organization, or body of a partisan political nature. B. Small Roman I, small Roman II. D, E, F, G on page 5, just before we get there.
Sorry, madam.
Yes, that's why I said just before we get there, Honourable McIntosh.
Look, I'm sure it doesn't apply. But I think the department might give us, where it says personally.
What number is that?
We're at B, we're on B, BB. Personally or through a spouse sponsor that has or requires a direct or indirect financial interest in the registrant. You know, my concern is one might buy shares in the stock exchange. Now, I mean, you hardly have a, but you do actually have an interest. I'm sure that's excluded, and I don't know how many registrants would it be actually listed on the stock exchange, for example. You know, I don't think it's a factor, really, but it just is a slight concern.
Now, I take your point. The same crossed my mind, notwithstanding that I got no shares. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. In fact, the Chairperson was just going to get to the subsection that deals with that. On page 5, from line 6, subsection 6 reads, for the purpose of subsection 5B, the... this is the personally or through a spouse, partner, associate,
okay,
has a required direct or indirect financial interest. It does not include an indirect interest held in any funds or investment if the person contemplated in that subsection has no control over the investment decision of that fund or investment. And of course, investment will include shares and those.
Are we quite covered?
Yes, I'm sure we are.
Good. So we were at the end of F there on page 4, coming to page 5, G, 6, 7, which we just referred to as well, just before that, 6 and 7, 8, A, B, small Roman I, small Roman 2. Nine, if at any time it appears to a member of the tribunal that a matter being considered by the tribunal during the proceedings concerns an interest of that member referred to in 8B, that member must A, immediately and fully disclose issues, B, withdraw from the proceedings. 10. I have just got one question myself here. How many members of the tribunal are there now, incidentally? By law?
Chairperson, the tribunal must consist of at least 10 members and the chairperson. Currently, there are 13 members of the tribunal, 3 full-time members and 10 part-time members.
So under the law, you're allowed to have how many members?
There is not an upper limit, Chairperson, but there is a minimum. And if that number drops below the minimum, we not correct and we cannot hear any matters, whether it is a 3-member panel or 1-member panel.
What is that minimum?
That minimum is 10 and the Chairperson, Honourable Chairperson.
So when somebody has to recuse themselves, that's what I'm saying. You're in the middle of a proceeding. And then, you know, you get the smack and you come down to 8 or 9. What happens there?
Every panel, the tribunal operates by way of panels, Honourable Chairperson. In the legislation, it provides that you can either have one person, a panel, who can hear the less complicated matters, and then you have hearings where there must be 3 members present to form a quorum.
Van der Merwe, any comments? Are we all satisfied?
Mm.
Right. 9A, 11, proceedings of the tribunal and any decisions taken by a majority of the members present and entitled to participate are binding despite a member of the tribunal having failing to disclose an interest. Everyone's happy. B. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, on this subsection 11, members did express a concern of why should proceedings remain, well, at that stage it was valid, despite a person not disclosing an interest. And when we looked at this again, I thought, I'm not sure that we actually adequately explained it to the members. So if I can just get that opportunity. The wording was that it would remain valid and it was in relation to a meeting at first. That's what it read at first. Now, the reason for having a meeting valid, despite someone attending who should not be there, who has an interest, is simply because they might have been, you need to look at the circumstances of each situation. So the person who might have been there might have had an interest. It might have been an interest of such a nature, although it is definitely an interest, the person did not partake during the discussion, etc. And you don't want that decision then to be invalid simply because the person was there. Of course, there will still have to be steps taken against that person. Why did you not appear? Why were you there? But it goes further, because what we then done, what we then did was to change this, because the tribunal, we don't want to regulate their meetings. The meetings that they will have will be administrative in nature. There's not real decision of importance that will be taken there. The important decision is during a hearing. Now, why we have changed this to a hearing, we also changed the word valid.
Yes.
We said we don't want it valid despite someone being there who should have declared an interest or might have an interest, because valid might affect a later on review. So we changed it to binding. Now, the reason for this is you might be sitting, the three-member panel sits, for instance, and it's a week-long case after 4 days of intense hearings, of evidence being laid before them. There is suddenly something that pops up in the evidence of a witness that indicates a certain company might be involved in a collusion. And suddenly one of the tribunal members said, whoa, we now need to stop this. I did not realize that there is this possibility of collusion. I will withdraw from here on. But you don't want those 4 days to suddenly fall flat. So that is why we said we keep them binding, because there might be those innocent situations where someone is there with an interest, but they didn't realize it. Of course, if it is something where someone did have an interest, it might also be that the decision is still in the favor of the person, of the consumer, or the credit provider is satisfied with the outcome. They don't want to take this on review. They're satisfied with it, with what the outcome was. Then we still want that decision to be binding. The fact that the commission or the tribunal member, the panel member, should not have been there is then an internal matter that the tribunal will have to take up with that person. But it should not affect the actual decision, because the fact that one of them has an interest is in fact grounds for review. It is one of the reasons to take something on review. So we want it binding so that it can be taken on review. Otherwise, you're almost sitting in a loop where you can't do anything because it isn't a binding decision. But now where do you go? So if it's binding, but the person has an interest, then that will simply be a ground for review.
Thank you. And I see Dr. Ronyana Mokabane, you agree with that. They're representing DTI. Thank you. Now over to our members. Right, can I have someone to propose adoption? Thank you, Honourable Kwabatha, seconded by Honourable Y.E. Right. We now move, still on page 5, to amendment of section 29 of Act 34, 2005. Clause 7. Section 29 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution of subsection 5 of the paragraph A of the following. A must remove the chairperson or any other member of the tribunal from office if that person becomes subject to any of the disqualifications referred to in 22. As you know, that will be popping up. So that measure, you know, is serious, and I think it was a consequential thing here, the 26-5, just a numbering issue, per se. All right. So can we have someone to propose adoption of
Honourable McIntosh, seconded by the Honourable Swanepoel. Right. Bottom of page 5. Amendment of Section 32 of Act 34 of 2005, Clause 8. There we are. We've got the principal act is hereby amended by the substitution of subsection 2 for the words preceding A of the following words. If during a hearing in which a member of the tribunal is participating, it appears, and I think we're going through the same issue here that was just being explained. Am I right, members? We heard the advocate's explanation thereof. And we have someone on 8.2, clause 8, and that substitution to please propose adoption of that clause. Thank you, Honourable Kwabasa, seconded by the Honourable. The Honourable Swanepoel here. Yeah, we just got to keep our heads above water here, all right. Page 6. Substitution of Section 34 of Act 34 of 2005, Clause 9. The following section is hereby substituted for Section 34 of the Principal Act, Remuneration and Benefits. I'm reminded that we always ought to look, take a double look at these remuneration and benefits so we don't allow people just to award themselves these handsome bonuses. Right, it says here, the Minister may, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, do you see that, in consultation, determine salary, allowances, benefits, etc. I think the main point there is that we agreed that this would be done in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And people wouldn't just dream up a good idea for a bonus or salary is what's been happening in our country. Two, the salary, allowances or benefits of the tribunal member of the tribunal may not be reduced during the term of office of such a member. In a way, they've got more protection than members of parliament. All right, if you're happy with that. Clause 9. We have someone to propose adoption. Honourable Y. Ely, seconded by Honourable James, thank you. Yes. Seconded, of clause that one. Right. The amendment of Section 40 of Act 34, 2005. This one's the principal act here. Clause 10. Right. Is hereby amended. Section 40 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following subsection. One, a person must apply to be registered as a credit provider. If A, that person alone or in conjunction with any associated person is the credit provider under at least 100 credit agreements, other than incidental credit agreements. Just a minute.
It's deleted.
You'll remember we took this also, we took advice from our consultant, remember, and then the advocate and DTI also and NCR appreciating that their intention would be captured best by this deletion. And I'm looking at the CEO there as well, yes. So we agree there. Okay. The total, B, the total principal debt owed, that all remains the same, I think, to the credit provider under all outstanding credit agreements, other than incidental credit agreement, exceeds the threshold prescribed in terms of Section 42.1. And I'll remind members, refer to the consultant's comments here, which we discussed last night for 3 hours. Right. We have someone to propose adoption of Clause 10. Honourable Swanepoel, was that a hand? Thank you. Honourable Swanepoel proposes adoption, seconded by Honourable McIntosh. Right. Amendment of Section 42 of Act 34 of 2005, Clause 11. Section 42 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following. and that we have a deletion, and then we have the minister, by notice in the Gazette, must determine a threshold for the purpose of determining. This is all in relation to the previous one, which the consultant gave us a page on. And we agreed last night, are we still in that agreement?
Yes.
Proposed adoption, please, Honourable Kwabasa, seconded by. On the mic, you see, apparently now the voice isn't captured on when it's off the mic, yeah. Yes, just reminding me, but you didn't do that with everyone, Mr. Herman. Right, and Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, I didn't think I needed to be on the mic because you've come over very strongly on the mic and you mentioned the name of the proposal seconded in each occasion. But if Mr. Hermans would like
No, I'd like to propose something else. I think if you think I've captured your name wrongly and it was someone else, put your hand up and object.
Yeah.
Because I just think, Mr. Hermans, I'm not spending the night here. Please, page 6. That's adopted, right? Page 6, we now move to clause, the insertion of section 44A in Act 34 of 2005. Clause 12, this is an insertion, a major insertion. PDAs, remember them. Right, the following section is hereby inserted in the Principal Act after section 44. Registration of payment distribution agents. That is a very good example of how employment is created by innovative people in business. There we are, the PDA sprang up all over and we now register them, 44A. And I do understand, Honourable James, you discussed your other urgent meeting that you would need to leave for in literally 2 minutes. 44A1. A person may apply to the National Credit Regulator to be registered as a PDA. And 2, remember we've been over these points, but it is a new idea. A person must not offer or engage in the services of a PDA or hold themselves out to the public as being authorized to offer any such service unless that person is registered as a PDA in terms of this chapter. We discussed this issue of chapter, do you recall, last night? And it was agreed that, no, needn't be this act. Just refresh our memories, Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the reason why we're using the word chapter is simply to align this amendment bill with the way that the National Credit Act currently reads. It is divided into chapters, and in those chapters, it refers to within this chapter. So where it's only a chapter that's applicable, we are just continuing the phrasing used by the Act so that it is aligned, and therefore we are using chapter.
Right. Everyone agreed there?
Yeah.
Fine. Consumer is not obliged to make use of the services of a PDA. 3. In addition to the requirements of Section 46, an applicant for registration as a PDA must satisfy any prescribed education, experience, or competency. And 4. It then goes on. And this Treasury, through the DDG, was much at home with. PDA agents must A, maintain fidelity insurance and trust accounts, and B, submit financial accounts as may be reasonably required by the National Credit Regulator for purposes of a financial audit. 5, no credit provider shall have any direct or indirect interest which is inconsistent with the objects of this Act and the management or control of the business operations of a PDA or debt counselling business. 6. Any natural or juristic. We tackle the whole thing of that for a full morning and we stuck to. Do we all recall that? Natural or juristic. There we are. That is the ones I wanted to alert you to. Now, can we have someone to propose adoption, probably just as you leave, Honourable James?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Seconded by Honourable Kwabasa. Right, okay. And thank you very much. You see, When I look here, we do have a quorum, just to remind members. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Honourable Salah. Who's not incognito, if he wasn't in us room. And I want to say we do appreciate you literally sprinting here, but then your squash has stood you in good stead. Right. Amendment of section 45. 45? On page 7. Of Act 34, 2005, clause 13. And that one, the straightforward one, halfway down, we see it's 13A. In the middle there, the commas are removed, as it were, and we note subject to section 48, unless the National Credit Regulator, not just, you know, not a subjecting applicant to a fit and proper test or any other issue that may disqualify him from being registered in terms of this act. So we just put a little, we strengthen that one there. B, by the addition of the following subsections. The minister may prescribe the criteria, we spent a lot of time on this, to be considered in conducting a fit and proper test contemplated in subsection 3. 5. The minister may prescribe the criteria for registration as well as the duties, obligations and fees that may be charged by a registrant. So you look at what we've just said under A, is the view that they are compelling, you know, if there is the view, you've got to be fit and proper test or any other prescribed test, is of the view that there are other compelling grounds that disqualify the applicant from being registered. So it's just deepening or strengthening the act so that we hopefully close the loopholes in this regard. Can we have someone to propose adoption of clause 13? Honourable McIntosh, seconded by
Madam Chair, okay. The question to the department and maybe the national or the person who did the national credit regulator. What I'd like to know is when they talk about other compelling grounds, could they give us some examples of what these compelling grounds might be?
You've just looked in at a very critical point, Chief Director Nancy Tenzi. I don't know if you wanted to leave it to your colleague, Dr. Nonyana Mukabani, to answer. Well, just before you do, it will allow you time to confer, Honourable Kwabasa.
Yes, just that last part of paragraph 916. If you could take it from the beginning, it reads like the minister may prescribe the criteria for registration as well as the duties and obligations. And it sounds like obligations be charged by the registrant. I wondered whether we could say and prescribe fees that may be charged.
All right, I hear what you're saying. You're saying if we read it as it is, the minister may prescribe the criteria for registration we have no problem with.
Yeah,
as
like
well as, then we go on. Because the criteria would then also apply to the next lot of the registrant. May prescribe the criteria, also the duties, the obligations, and fees. Did you say it doesn't read that well? Or
it sounds like...
Just on record?
Okay. it sounds like the duties and obligations may be charged. And I'm saying it's fine up to obligations, and then there's, we would say, and may prescribe fees that may be charged. Is that superfluous or is it?
Now I hear what you're saying. Now it looks like we're going to be charging for the obligations, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, with respect to my colleague, what you've got here is the minister may prescribe, which is the verb, which is, and it has as the object of that verb, he may prescribe. The one object is the criteria, as well as he may prescribe the duties, he may prescribe the obligations, and he may prescribe the fees that may be charged by a registrant. I agree it might be a bit more elegant to say may prescribe the criteria for registration for duties, obligations, and also the fees or something to make it so that there's no misunderstanding. But it, to me, dramatically, I think in a matter of interpretation, fees is the object of the verb may prescribe, as are the other ones. But it is a little confusing, because after fees, it says that may be charged by a registrant. Because in a sense, the object isn't fees, it's fees that may be charged by a registrant. But I don't know what some clever lawyer who's trying to persuade the judge about something might try to do with that. They probably employ Mr. Tabasa to be the lawyer.
No, I think that
or his son.
You've epitomized the Scotsman's understanding of English. And I once remember my own father telling me the Scots taught the English how to speak English. So, you know, I do understand where you're coming from. So, now I do appreciate that. But let's turn to our advocate here first, just to make sure that grammatical issue is not being misunderstood before we come to the substance thing.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think what we can perhaps do to put members' minds at rest and make sure that our bill reads the way it should be reading, putting something up on the screen, is I think we can perhaps take away the word as well as where we've put it, because I think that might be what's creating the problem. And so that you put a comma in after registration, because then the way the Honourable McIntosh explained it, I think will be clearer.
Yeah.
Because then it will be may prescribe the criteria for registration, comma. So you know that's the first thing that he may prescribe. The duties, comma. That's the second thing. Maybe to insert the obligations. And then we can say, maybe not and, but make it a clearer break, and then say, as well as
the fees
that may be charged by a registrant. So then I think there's a much clearer
and
break
be clearer.
In everything.
And then I turn to Dr. Nonyana Mokabana. That is the intention, what you've just heard Advocate Madam Murder say or suggest.
I'm not necessarily responding to what she just said, Madam Chair, but earlier on I remember a query was raised in connection with the part that speaks about other compelling grounds.
Yes.
What could those other compelling grounds
yes.
be?
Yes.
Speaking also on behalf of the team, there could be any circumstantial grounds which may not be ordinary, but also not noted, you know, in the Act. So that actually leaves a room for such. Unless if my other colleagues maybe want to make a comment. NCR?
Thank you. Honourable Chair, there are instances where when we do an investigation, at the time when we want to register an entity, that you find that, you know, a director of that company is involved in fraudulent activities elsewhere. And that could be a compelling ground for us to, you know, perhaps not register that entity.
Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I just have a slight concern, and again, because I may be ignorant of other parts of this, and it's quite a complicated a set of amendments, that some, I don't want to use a bad word, but some person will say, I've been disqualified, and the NCR says other compelling grounds, and there's no definition, and then the court will say, you can't just decide for yourself what those compelling grounds are. Now, maybe somewhere the NCR has a list of what they would describe as compelling grounds, I mean, I'm just, for example, thinking of one example. Somebody who speaks very poor English. I mean, supposing it's a Serbian visitor, a Serbian permanent resident, and he starts a business and he can't deal with it. Or maybe there's, they're very rude and difficult with the NCR, and they don't. I'm just concerned that if people are looking for loopholes in a law, other compelling grounds is a very broad statement. Unless you have in your situation something for that.
No, we hear you on the Macintosh. I want to turn to Advocate Quetta, the State Legal Advisor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chair, the issue raised by Honorable Macintosh is valid. And there is a particular court judgment, Chair, factual, that stated that laws must be drafted in a clear manner to ensure legal certainty. But the court did go ahead and went further and said that laws that are drafted with perfect lucidity sometimes may defeat the purpose that is trying to be achieved by the legislation. There was sometimes a law may need to be wide so that it can capture everything, so that nothing falls through the cracks. So that was a particular court judgment of facial. Therefore, in my view, the compelling grounds means that nothing may escape.
But we also heard your point that the court has, through one of its judgments, and perhaps several, indicated that we must be more specific. What for me is a compelling ground may not be the same as somebody else chairing, and I think it's in that respect that you've alerted us as well. It's a difficult one just to throw open to all of you sitting here, but let me try the Chief Executive Officer, who does expect to give us something.
Honourable Chair, in instances where the person feels that we did not give them a third reason why we did not register them, they are entitled to appeal to the National Consumer Tribunal. But we would normally, give them reasons why it is that we feel that we cannot register.
Thank you very much, Chief Director Nancy Kennedy.
No, thanks. Thanks, Chair, and Honourable Members. I just wanted to say, in terms of the Constitution, we are generally, in particular, bodies like the NCR and the Tribunal, as well as the courts, are compelled to give reasons if they want to. If they are denying somebody, say to register, as an example, even our judgments, we are compelled to give reasons. So in my view, this issue of crafting the language or otherwise is a matter of interpretation. But at the same time, you must give reasons why you don't want to register that person. And if that person is not happy, then there is a higher body to appeal or to review. So in that regard, I propose that it be accepted that reasons will be finished. If they are not satisfactory, then there is a second layer to revisit that. Then.
Okay. So they can appeal the reasons.
Honourable Macintosh, have you satisfied yourselves that that would be in order and that you accept the DTI's response that explanation that they'd have to give reasons for these so-called compelling reasons? And if you were not satisfied with that as a person, you could then still go to the tribunal. Is that right? Appeal there.
No, I think the important thing is the DTI said that when they give their reasons, they set them out. So that means that any litigious person, if they still want to go to law, they can go to law, but nobody can say to them what they just, you know, decided because they didn't like the my bad breath. They disqualified me because of halitosis.
Yes, someone to propose adoption with that amendment. Honourable Honourable Kwabasa. Honourable Salah, you?
No, right.
Seconded by Honourable Salah. Right. I wouldn't want to miss you, Honourable Salah. You're very welcome to come to the front row at any time. You're happy there, right?
I can see clearly
okay.
Now.
Okay, thank you. That's a good one, yeah. Amendment of Section 46 of Act 34 of 2005, Clause 14. A. B. May I have someone to propose adoption? Thank you, Honourable Waili, seconded by Honourable Swanepoel. Amendment of Section 48 of Act 34, 2005, Clause 15. Section 48 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. A. B. I think this is an important one, B. Of a substitution in subsection 1 for paragraph B of the following paragraph B, the commitments, if any, made by the applicant or any associated person in connection with combating, this is what this bill is about, over-indebtedness, and compliance with a prescribed code of conduct, as well as affordability assessment regulations, made by the Minister on the recommendation of the National Credit Regulator. We're looking at this, we discussed this, this took care of affordability issues. Right. And remember all the ands, we discussed this yesterday, why have we got all the commas, the semicolons in here, and we got the explanation from yourself, Advocate Quetta, on that. Thank you very much. This was last night. So with that, under C then, 1A, the Minister may prescribe criteria and measures to determine the outcome of affordability assessments provided for in this section. I think that really adds some substance to the Act, you know, and strengthen it and give it stronger teeth. We have someone to propose adoption of Clause 15. Thank you, Honourable Salah, seconded by Honourable Kwabasa. Insertion.
They were saying it all well.
They were. Yeah, but you know, I missed you. So, insertion of Section 48A in Act 34 of 2005. Clause 16. The following section is hereby inserted in the Principal Act after Section 48. Code of Conduct. I'm sure we will never forget what that means. Code of Conduct. Right. And it's a long inclusion. Do you see that? It starts at the bottom of page 7. 48A, the Minister may prescribe a code of conduct contemplated in Section 48.1b only after the National Credit Regulator has A, published the proposed code of conduct for public comment. Remember, we thought that was very important, and it is. Considered any submissions made during the public comment period. On page 8, C, consulted with small Roman 1, persons conducting business within the relevant industry, and Roman 2, small Roman 2, relevant accredited persons, and D, made any revisions to the proposed industry code as published for comment. 2. A code of conduct must be consistent with the purposes of this Act. 3. The National Credit Regulator, A, must monitor the effectiveness of any code of conduct issued in terms of this Act, and B, may reasonably require persons conducting business within the relevant industry to provide information necessary for the purposes of small Roman 1, monitoring in terms of paragraph A, or 2, reviewing the effectiveness of a prescribed code of conduct relevant or relative to the purposes of this act. 4. A registrant must not, in the ordinary course of business, contravene an applicable code of conduct as contemplated in section 48(1)(b). Now, all I want to ask myself here is more of a crafting issue. I see sometimes, like under 8, on page 8, B small Roman 1, 3, B small Roman 1, we say, as we said here, monitoring in terms of paragraph A. On other occasions, we say in terms of 3A. You know what I mean? So it's just because I'd like to improve my own understanding. You see, because I see sometimes you do it this way, and it's like, do I use salt or pepper? You know, and then sometimes you use another way. So both seem okay. Why? Oh, yes, advocate Quetta.
Actually, sure, they are different.
Okay.
In 3, in this beer, we say paragraph A.
Mm-hmm.
We say paragraph A because we are now within that one subsection. If it is another subsection, then we're going to say subsection 3B or paragraph. That's what we say to another subsection here.
Okay.
So that is difference. If
so
we're within, if we are within a particular subsection, then we should be just to a paragraph.
Right. So if we're in that specific subsection, then that, if you like, is the convention, if I may put it that way. Thank you. I think it's helped me. Yes, Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, two just very minor things. I think in B, that's B now, it says, for the purposes of, I think there should be a space before that line, after the of. And then, you see, it's very interesting that you should have raised that query in terms of monitoring in terms of paragraph A, because my eye took me straight to 48A, published the proposed code of conduct for public comment. So, just because one is looking at it, you say, well, that A refers to the first A in the clause, which is on page 7, in line 53. But now we're informed that A must refer to 3A, whereas I personally think it would be better to have the 3, and then there's no confusion, because in this clause there are 2 A's. And you need to know which A you're talking about. But look, I'm not a legal drafts person, but certainly it's just interesting. And I just immediately read, I saw A, and then I thought, well, what on earth are they talking about? Monitoring in terms of paragraph A. And then I looked at A, which was on the previous page, and I said, no, there's something wrong here. Whereas if they had 3A, I wouldn't have made that error. But please, I don't want to rewrite drafting rules. If the advocate's happy with it and the department's happy with it, they're fine. No problem. I'm happy.
No, that's how I felt, and I think you and I were on the same wavelength there. That's why we jumped all over. But you know, not all over, but you know, just in that little section. But it just shows we were both thinking that way. But the majority here in the committee don't know what we're talking about. So. but I do understand very much what you're saying, but we are reassured by Advocate Quetta. Thank you. So on that basis then, can we move for the adoption of clause 16?
Well, since my eye went immediately to PA, I will.
Yes, I think that's wise, right. So proposed by Honourable Swanepoel, seconded by?
Myself.
Oh, Honourable Salah, thank you, myself.
I thought you'd done it long ago.
No, thank you, Honourable Salah. Amendment of Section 49 of Act 34, 2005. Clause 17. A, B, C. Well, we've already dealt with compelling, remember? We have someone to propose adoption. That Honourable McIntosh there. Yeah, followed by Honourable Waihili. Right. Now we move to amendment of Section 51 of Act 34, 2005. And that is Clause 18. A penalty. Some of us should be applying for penalty to become penalty referees. We focused a lot on penalties, didn't we? It's just a pity the Honourable Maria isn't here because he could have indicated whether it should be yellow or red carded. A, B, or C. D, it will be here any minute judging from the SMS. Now, we must remember he's coming from Worcester or somewhere. Worcester. It's a long way, isn't it? Away with the vineyards. Right. Clause 18. So can we have someone to propose adoption there? Are we happy about the 30 days? Do you remember we discussed that issue? And we decided to move away from business, calendar, and all of that, and just say 30 days. Right. Propose adoption then, someone. Thanks, Honourable McIntosh. Seconded by Honourable Kobasa. Amendment of Section 52, Act 34 of 2005. Clause 19. And there again, that's interesting. Now this we spent time on. 19.4, Section 52 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution in subsection 4 for the paragraph B of the following paragraph. B remains in effect until small Roman 1, the registrant, is deregistered. Small Roman 2, the registration is cancelled in terms of this Act, or 3, it has lapsed on the last day upon which the prescribed renewal fee should have been paid in terms of Section 51.1c. Everyone happy? Someone to propose adoption.
I do.
Honourable Salah, thank you for that. I do. And seconded by Honourable McIntosh. Insertion of 58A in Act 34 of 2005. Clause 20. The following section is hereby inserted in the Principal Act of Section 58. Additional requirements for cancellation, 58A. This is quite a big insertion and important. A registrant who voluntarily requests that his or her registration be cancelled must A. submit a notice in the prescribed manner and form and an affidavit to the National Credit Regulator stating the registrant's small Roman 1 intention to voluntarily cancel his or her registration. You remember who we're talking about when we talk of the registrant? Do you remember? Because terrible if we're all getting lost. And it is?
It is any person who can be registered in terms of the Act. So it will include credit providers, it will include debt counsellors, it will include CDA.
So this is the thing, it's broad. It's across the board. The registrant's intention to voluntarily cancel his or her, and then we go to 9.4. 3, B, the important one here is at the top of page B as well, attached to the said notice, proof that all the affected consumers, credit providers and or credit bureaus. There was some idea that we were supposed to have put an X there, not an S. So what is the English convention here in South African English law? Advocate Quetta.
Chair, I think we can remain with that S, Chair, rather than the S that we are not
talking about. Yeah. Yet another, I think, indication that we are South Africans here in a region of Africa. So bureaus, with an S somewhere, have been notified about the intended cancellation. See attached to the said notice, the registration certificate issued to that registrant by the NCR. I think the big thing for us was to show that you've notified your clients. You know, you just didn't disappear. Isn't that what we thought was important? Right. And then further on, there's C, there's 2. And then the important one here is under 2, line 11, 1B. About the consumers having been transferred to another registrant chosen by the consumer. 3A. B. 4. The minister may prescribe the procedure for handover and transfer of records of consumers where the registrant ceases to operate for any reason. Remember, including cancellation of registration, lapsing of registration, death. Or we added under legal advice or incapacity. Right. Can we have someone to propose the adoption
of... Madam Chair.
Yes, Honourable McIntosh.
I don't want to become ridiculously pedantic, but I think in 4, the Minister may prescribe the procedure for the handover and transfer of records. Would be more a better grammar.
Handover is a verb, yeah. He said the handover is a...
You know, what I'm going to suggest in this case, because you certainly helped us in the other case, and I think that one was important because it meant the clarity thereof. I think here, it's similar to bureaus, there's a kind of South African, just as South Africans are the only one who understand the word expression just now, nobody else does, except South Africans. So we all understand for handover, but I do want to just lean on the side of caution, Advocate Glendalyn.
Chairperson, both reads fine.
So can we then leave it as it is? Happy with that, Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, another way of doing it is for handing over, because I think the point that colleague Swanepoel is making is valid. Handover is actually a verb here, unless you see it as
a noun.
Yeah. If it's a noun, then it should be for handing over and transferring of records, or it should be for the handover and drop. But look,
I
what it means.
Your point, for the handover, or for handing over, and I'm going to take you back 50 years, is a gerund noun, which presupposes action.
Good, you know about gerunds.
Yes, I do. I studied that. Right, so what are we going to do here? Because we do want this fully understood, don't we? I'm looking at Honourable Swanepoel.
Oh, that's good, handing over.
But you know, you've been deployed now in the Honourable Van der Merwe's position of being our grammarian in the committee with Honourable McIntosh. So you can't just throw away that deployment. Okay. So are we going to say the procedure for handing over or the handover? I'm looking at you, Honourable. the advocate question.
The chair, I think both phrases chair would be appropriate for the handover or for handing over chair. Probably can decide.
All right, we'll stick with the simpler one of the. The. I hope people realise that we mustn't give Krita too much work. I mean it seriously. I don't know if they were going on strike or sitting or what. Clause 20, can I have someone to propose adoption? Oh, sorry, Chief Director Nyetsi Tenzi.
No, thanks, Chair. Mine is when you were asking a person to ask to say, do we still recall who is a registrant?
Yes.
Yes. Something came to our minds to say, yes, we know, but it seems as if there is somebody called alternative dispute resolution.
Yes.
So I don't know whether we're confused because we're tired, but we want to be guided. If that is the case, it should be slotted in maybe on page 7, line 25 and 26. If we are right, if we are not right, we can leave it.
Thank you, Chairperson. I did not mention alternative dispute resolution agents, but they're also registrants. The new insertion section 134A requires that they must be registered with the National Credit Regulator, so they will also be registrants.
You see, that's why I asked this question. Are we all aware? Remember, and we shouldn't say we're tired. There are two Red Bulls still in my fridge, because I don't drink. We're not going to say we are tired. Anyone that's we're available, the bread balls are rather not me. So, please, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nitchitens takes us back to page 7 and the amendment of section 46.
Yes.
And the court, it says that a natural person may not be registered, and then a natural person may not be registered. But an alternative dispute resolution person might be a jury. But anyway, why don't we mention alternative dispute in this section 46 then? Is there any reason? Where does the registrant or the fourth category of registrant come in the Act? That's all I'd like to know.
No. In fact, we're coming to that. You know, the content specialist has alerted me here on my left. What page is it on? Page 13, there is on clause 35, line 40. Could you just talk to that, Ms. Hurley?
Oh, well, then it's all here.
What clause 35 focuses on how to register and deregister alternative dispute resolution agents, and I believe Ms. Nechitenzi might be referring that this might have to move into that current chapter on registration, or not.
Right, Chief Director.
No, thanks. I think it is somewhere at the... Ms. Helen has said it's better to leave it as it is because it's catered for somewhere as a registrant so that we should be give credit to a present.
Right, so let's try and pass clause 20, adopt clause 20, someone to propose. You're welcome to put in a little adoption here and there, Honourable Shorpe Sotole. No, can we have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Kovasa, seconded by Honourable McIntosh. And there's an agreement that it was with the amendment of the insertion of the handover. amendment of section 71 of Act 34 of 2005, clause 21. Section 71 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for subsections 1, 2, 3 and 4 of the following subsections respectively. 1. A consumer whose debts have been rearranged in terms of Part D. Of this chapter. That is terms of Part D of this chapter. Section 71 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution of subsections 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the following subsections respectively. 1. Consumer whose debts have been rearranged in terms of Part D of this chapter. Right, and that in the Principal Act is, you can refer to 78, 79, it's page 10 onwards, Part D is over indebtedness and reckless credit. Now this is the core of this whole Act, proposed amendment bill. You must understand, we must be sure. We remove may apply and we substitute it with must be issued. This is the whole crux of this bill, with a clearance certificate by a debt counsellor within 7 days. And notice we never spoke about business calendar or any other days, or indeed how long it took to make the will. But within 7 days, it had to be done. So just reminding members about these things after the consumer has paid. This is very important. Satisfied all the obligations under every credit agreement that was subject to that debt arrangement order or agreement. Remember, finance was here, raised the issue of the mortgage. Remember that? Don't say we overlooked that, that was subject to that debt arrangement or order or agreement in accordance with that order or agreement, or B, demonstrated financial ability to satisfy future obligations in terms of the rearrangement order or agreement under AAA mortgage agreement, which secured a credit agreement for the purchase of or improvement of immovable property, or double B, any other long-term agreement as may be prescribed. 2. That there are no arrears on the rearranged agreements contemplated in subparagraphs small Roman 1. And 3. That all obligations under every credit agreement included in the rearrangement order or agreement other than those contemplated in subparagraph 1 have been settled in full. Small Roman I. 2. A debt counsellor must, for the purposes of the demonstration envisaged in subsection 1b, apply such measures as may be prescribed. So this was with Treasury present, there was engagement, and I looked to our own legal advisor on this point. That then satisfied the concern that did arise with respect to mortgage agreement, except the fact that what we were saying, you know, we're talking about a mortgage agreement. Their concern was, in the first place, it should affect primary. Do you remember that issue? The house over your head, not the holiday home. And we had that engagement with them, Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. In fact, Chairperson, the Commission decided not to accept the proposal from Treasury. Treasury wanted to exclude mortgage agreements from debt review. And the concern was then that, or rather, let me put it, rephrase it, it sounded initially
as if Treasury wanted to exclude mortgage agreements from debt review.
Yes.
And then they indicated that they wanted to have a more pronounced place in preferential treatment, but it's already getting preferential treatment because it is a secure debt. And they did indicate they would give something, but DTI was saying the way that it is, you know, there is sufficient protection. This now allows for a person to be issued with a clearance certificate, even though the mortgage agreement is still being paid off, because that could be 30 years. So that was sufficient, and the committee accepted that the way that we have it here gives sufficient protection to the consumer in respect of that the mortgage agreement is not something that will pull them down.
All right. So can we have someone, you know, we're moving rapidly because that was the crux there, I'm sure you recall. 3, 4. It's all about these clearance certificates, all right? And then if the debt counsellor under B at the bottom of the page fails to file a certified copy of a clearance certificate as contemplated here, consumer may file a certified copy of such certificate with the National Credit Regulator. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I just have a question for the DTI. Practically speaking, I mean, the whole country is going on to electronics. Even the old ladies in Mthatha and in Norbo are even now going on to smartphones and Facebook. But the concern I've got is if a credit bureau has 7 days, which is quite a short time really to clean a record, are they satisfied that they have the capacity? Now, I think there is capacity. I mean, if you think you go to a pharmacy, and if you happen to be at a medical aid, they literally instantly put that thing through, because they've got that, whatever it is, Wi-Fi or internet system.
Yeah.
Now, I don't see why credit bureaus shouldn't do the same. I mean, so 7 days under those circumstances are fair enough. Or credit providers, I mean, not credit bureaus, I must use the right terminology. So, but what I'd want to know is the department satisfied that its registrants, its registered credit, or perhaps the NCR should tell us that, whether they have that kind of capacity to communicate with the credit bureaus quickly enough within 7 days. That's my only concern.
Okay. Well, that's why I did emphasize the 7 days. Absolute silence, right? That worries me on my left. I think we did go down the street. You may not be present, but we raised this issue about the term, you know, the timing here. Someone asked that very question. I'll be frank, I don't recall the response. You know, I know we got a response. Yes, Chief Director.
Thanks. So I assume that we're talking about the credit bureaus. This at least the 7 days and capacity. Yes. Yes, our response was positive that can be done. And then we also informed the committee that we met with the credit bureaus.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And then they raised the concern,
yes,
of capacity, in particular of the small bureaus,
yes,
in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
But here, when they responded, even at the DTI, they said to us that actually the people who are delaying to submit the information are the credit providers,
mm-hmm,
not necessarily the man or woman who is a credit bureau who does not have capacity in the rural outskirts of Transkei. No, they said the problem is with the credit providers.
Okay.
So we came to a conclusion to say, really, we want things to be done in 7 days. That was the response.
So in other words, let's chivvy these people up.
I used a bad terminology. What I meant was credit providers, or the debt manager.
Right, nice.
So let's suppose Spanbahn or Mrs. Van der Maveren Forfader. She hasn't paid her telecom account and or whatever it is, and she's now borrowed money. You know, from
the
Droogte Contant help. And she goes to Droogte Contant help. They say, but Mrs. Van der Merwe, you haven't paid your account. And they then must talk to her. Mrs. Van der Merwe says, okay, I've won the lotto. I've come, I'm paying all my debts in Pofada. So she pays off her 6,000 rand or whatever it might be. And then she's clean. Now my concern is that credit provider, Droogte Contant Hulp, is 7 days for them to inform the bureau enough time? Because
all
it's
right.
Them who must advise the bureau, and because these bureaus are very capacitated in terms of computers, but is the person in Pofata or Namakwe? Capacitate.
All right, but the issue then as well, have they got a license to provide credit? You see, and we've indicated here, you've got to have a license now, whether you're selling furniture or you're the local grocery store or whatever, you must be registered if you're providing credit. So, you know, when one comes to that and the little loans, you may well be right, they may not have been registered for that, but then you see these are valid agreements. CEO.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I do somewhat agree with Honourable McIntosh. It could be the days could be, you know, perhaps the committee can look at extending, you know, the number of days. I'm thinking here of small credit providers that don't have those sophisticated systems. You know, let alone debt counselors. The committee can perhaps look at, you know, extending the number of days from 7 days to, yes,
right.
Thank you.
Chief Director Nyati Tembi.
No, thanks. It should not be read since we are conflicting here, but time is of essence. We want the consumer,
sure.
We want the consumer to be alleviated of this burden. So time is of essence. Thanks.
Honourable Shorface of Tore.
Thank you, Chairperson. As a rural woman, my primary objective is to protect the consumer. And I think 7 days is enough.
Madam Chair, I think we're all agreed it's iniquitous that Mrs. Van Merwe and the lady Namakwe, call her Mrs. Makinta, that she has, that these two ladies have paid their debts.
Yeah.
And the credit bureaus still have given them a negative score. And that must be sorted out quickly.
Sure.
I don't think there's any disagreement on that. And I'm a rural man. and the point is, we want these people to do it easily. And I just had an incident. I have a tracker on my farm button, and we changed our bank account. We sent them a letter. We sent everything. They gave me a negative report when I pulled my credit. We sorted it out. But the point is, I can get on my computer, write a letter,
sure.
and initially phone them and give them help. But the lady in Pofater or Namakwe is not in that situation, and therefore we must make it an obligation on the credit provider and the credit bureaus to do this quickly.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is 7 days or 14 days. I certainly think it should be. And with computers and
devices. What are you proposing? 14
days?
No,
what I'm not. I just. I think I don't want to be prescriptive. I think 7 days is very quick in business, actually. So to me, something like 14 days. But then the credit provider should know that they must. They will be guilty of an offence if they do not advise the credit bureau that these two ladies have paid their debts.
All right, now let's just put this to two members. In principle, there's a concern on the issue. In principle, the time. Possibly in the rural areas you may face challenges here and may not actually be assisting where you want it to be. On the other hand, I mean, Honourable Sitori comes from the rural areas, and she's saying something else. She's saying if your primary concern is the consumer, then 7 days is enough. You see. So one more comment and a short comment from yourself, Honourable Swanepoel, and then we're moving to say whether we keep it at seven or raise it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to think how complicated a business process it will be. Now, for the big providers, that's not a problem. For the small providers, that's what we're talking about. Now, the small providers can't have very many applications in front of them. Secondly, not all those applications are arrears. There's only a small couple of applications in arrears. Okay. Now, what is the process? It will be paid. It will be lying in the legal department. 5 or 6 or 10 of these applications. It will be paid. They will check it's gone through the bank account. And they will issue a certificate. How complicated is that? I think 7 days is enough.
Right, on that basis, can we propose adoption as it stands? Honourable Shope Satori?
I propose adoption, Chair.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your active participation. Seconded by Honourable Waihiri. And this is what's healthy about it. By the time we get to the House, we can stand on our 2 feet and defend what we've agreed in as a committee. So that's why I am stopping at critical points. And I know departments and members are tired, but rest assured, I have not forgotten that we need to have liquid in our tummies. Now, clause 21, we've just adopted that. Can we now move to page 10? I just want to complete page 10, then there's tea, hot tea. Hot tea. Right, page 10, clause 22. The following section is here, insertion of section 71A of Act 34 of 2005. The following section is hereby inserted in the Principal Act after Section 71. Automatic removal. You see, this is what I'm saying. We're talking about the crux now. You know, the automatic removal of adverse consumer credit information. 71A. The credit provider must submit to all registered credit bureaus within 7 days after settlement by a consumer of any obligation under any credit agreement, information regarding each settlement where an obligation under such credit agreement was the subject of A, an adverse classification of consumer behavior, B, an adverse classification enforcement action against a consumer, C, an adverse listing recorded in the payment profile of the consumer, or D, a judgment debt. 2. The credit bureau must remove any adverse listing contemplated in subsection 1 within 7 days after receipt of such information from the credit provider. 3. If the credit credit provider fails to submit information regarding a settlement as contemplated in subsection 1, the consumer may lodge a complaint against such credit provider with the NCR. 4. For the purposes of this section, A. Adverse classification of consumer behavior means classification relating to consumer behavior and includes classification such as delinquent, default, slow paying, absconded, or not contactable. I hope nobody's listed me as uncontactable. B. Adverse classification of enforcement action means classification relating to enforcement action taken by the credit provider, including a classification such as handed over the collection or recovery, legal action or write-off. Now, we spend days on this, not hours. And we put this in so there is no misunderstanding. I look to you, there is a quorum. Can I have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Talal? Thank you. Seconded by?
Because I'm not moving yet.
You want to raise an issue, all right, Honourable McIntosh?
No, I don't want to raise an issue. I want to vote against the definition.
No, you see, it's a misinterpretation here. Proposed by Honourable Salah.
No.
Oh, you want to raise an issue, sorry.
Yes.
Honourable Salah.
Chairperson, when we read section 71A1, it gives the credit provider 7 days to submit information to the credit bureau. And subsection 2 gives the credit bureau another 7 days after receiving the information within which the credit bureau must remove the adverse information as contemplated within 7 days after receiving that. So it gives altogether 14 days process. Is that what we are saying?
Well, you can't remove it unless you've heard about it, received it. So it is a practical issue here. No, you can't remove something you know nothing about. So you have to give that bureau such time to get the information to then, in his or her time, to carry out certain action which does have a punishment, you know, which it would become an offence. So I believe that is the intention was. Advocate van der Merwe, does that indicate or underline the intention of the committee?
Chairperson, that's how I understood it. I just want to make it clear, I'm not sure that this is an offence.
Okay.
This non-providing of information. I might be wrong, maybe the credit regulator might be able to help us out, but it is not like this is a prohibited action. There's specific things that are identified as an offence.
Okay.
But what will happen is that if the information is not submitted, there can be a complaint.
Okay.
And then the National Credit Regulator can then act against the credit provider or the bureau.
All right, that clarifies it. Is that the clarification you sought, Honourable Salah?
Chairperson, the clarification I wanted was that we are agreeing that we're giving the whole process from the credit provider to the bureau and to the consumer. A period up to the maximum of 14 days.
Yes.
If that's what we are agreed upon, I'm fine. I will be clear on that. But we are giving the maximum of 7 days for the credit provider and the maximum of the
now
7 days after receipt.
I think that is the intention.
Okay. That I'm fine. I'm clear.
All right. Can we then, Honourable McIntosh, I don't know if that may have helped you before I put it to whether we want to adopt this or not.
Madam Chair, it does certainly help, and I think any credit bureau, you know, they don't work 24/7 7 days a week, so they've got to have a process and go through with it. Again, I don't think once again, and I think my colleague Swanepoel said we're not dealing actually with a huge number of these applications, and in fact, if you look at the figures that were presented in evidence, it was interesting to me that you're not talking about hundreds of thousands. You're actually talking about perhaps 100,000, which in the total economy of South Africa is not a huge number of people. But the concern I myself have is really in the definitions in the subclause 4, and also what it means in terms of removing the information, because if my understanding is correct, the idea is it must be deleted completely from the credit record. Now, if that's the case, I believe we are detracting from the quality of our credit records. To me, it's a positive if one says that it's recorded that this person has closed all their debts, but if they've had a record, that should be there on the record. But also, what is going to happen is it's like there was with HIV/AIDS, and some members of our family are doctors and work in hospitals. When you couldn't classify and say this person had AIDS, I mean, you could say they had TB or they had a problem with something, but you couldn't mention they had AIDS. Well, the medical professionals very quickly found a coded system. So if they didn't presume everybody was HIV, they just had a way to put a different colour on a card, and you knew that then they were HIV. I mean, human nature's like that, and what will happen is your credit bureaus will have a star system or something which will record this person actually has been through court judgments. And I just have a discomfort, because I think it's reducing the quality of our credit records, for which we have a global reputation. And a credit bureau and a credit record actually helps people who lend money to reduce the risk and lend it properly. And that is my concern. And it in fact doesn't affect such a large number of the community, because people will borrow money anyway. If they need the money, they will find a way to borrow it, even if they borrow it from the Mashonisa in the rural area near Zanin.
If I may say, we did discuss this at the time you were present, when we got the explanation of this, when we were not too sure what it meant. Will this mean there won't be a payment profile? It was explained very clearly to us. No. You must still be allowed to calculate risk. You must be. And that was agreed. So if I can just go through, you're very welcome, DDG. And we did, get your the reason for you coming later. I hope you are up to speed just where we are. And maybe you can repeat again what information is available after this would be removed. So I want to lend you money, and or whatever, a person, a consumer, I'd get the name and what else.
Thanks, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. Chair, we have indicated that the information that will remain will be the payment profile. All right, which is important to see how a person keeps up their obligations, as recorded. And we know that a number of concerns were raised before, but that was initially when people thought that this was a blanket removal of information.
That's where I think you're coming from.
And we're saying that there will still be a mechanism
to assess the risk. But I think over and above, Chair, the affordability guidelines, let me not move away from guidelines because they are still guidelines as the NCR was trying to publish them, but the affordability regulations will compel proper affordability assessment, because the risk is not only, you know, you can't price the risk only on the basis of the information that is on the credit bureau. And there are a number of factors that you take into account when you do the risk. In fact, a lot of people do pay even for a risk of a default, which has got nothing to do with you, but is a risk that the credit provider already puts into its calculation because it knows that there is a potential for default, not with you, but maybe with other you know, customers. So there are a number of factors that are there, but we think that the information that should be removed here, the reason why it's there is because it was a recorder of what you did. But once you pay up, then it should be removed on an ongoing basis. We see no reason why it should remain on there, because ordinarily, if it was a judgment and you were having money to go to court, you'll be able to rescind it immediately after paying up. But we don't want to keep our consumers to carry that burden of going to court. So we're cutting the costs for the consumer.
You know, an analogy here is that one goes to jail. Now you come out, and there isn't this list published which would have Joan Bob spent X in jail for Y, unless one is a sexual offender. And then, you know, we've now, as you know, recently passed such a piece of legislation. Now the argument there could be, now when I hire someone, I don't know if they've been to jail or not, so they fill in an employment form. Right? They fill it in. You don't know if I'm a jailbird or not, if I've been dishonest, if you like, you know. So it's during your engagement with this person, this prospective employee, that you would then elicit that. On the other hand, having had such an interview, you may still want to employ the person notwithstanding they've come out and you feel they've been rehabilitated and their skills are still needed. Now that is an employer of people. When you have done one of these things, which we now are calling adverse, you can't even get a job in many instances, let me put it that way. And we said at the beginning, we do not want to do this. We want to enable people to maintain employment. It also helps them to repay their debts at the same time. So while you are listed as having accounts, you have got these accounts. People know that. They know they can call for your wages, you know, what is your present remuneration, etc., how long have you been there. In other words, you're able as a bank or a lender to factor in a risk. And that is, in many respects, we heard what the so-called similar institutions such as Capitec are doing. And therefore they're able to provide these loans. And they're not getting the same default rate. But they are factoring in a price to cover this risk. So we're saying that in future, banks need to focus more on the affordability issues. Can their consumers afford this than others? And I'm saying all this, Honourable McIntosh, in the hope that after tea, you may have sufficient information to have a slightly different approach to the decision. So we're not taking a decision on page 10, clause 22, until after tea. Thank you. But we are coming back after tea to this issue. I just don't want our tea to get cold, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, no, let's rather come back to it after tea.
No.
I just want you and the committee and the DTI to understand what I'm trying to say, is that we have an amazing, internationally respected credit industry, if you want to call it that, both in terms of lending and borrowing. And we have a credit bureau or credit record which is the envy of most countries in the world. Mm-hmm. Now, a critical element of that reputation is the is keeping a record of every person's payment history. Now, part of that is the fact that many people go through difficult times, they run out of money, but they come back. And I believe these credit bureaus have more than sufficient sophistication and good records to be able to process those applications. I think what is very important, and which we're doing in this Act, is to say that the credit bureaus must, if somebody has managed to resolve their debt problems, they must record that positively on the record of that individual. But to just say these people must delete the records when a person hasn't met it, I mean, it's the same sort of amazing attitude that school teachers mustn't have inspectors in the classrooms. I mean, you just can't believe people can think like that. We need standards. We need to test things. And I believe there must be a record. So my concern is not about the injustice of keeping a person's bad record permanently in front of them. It's about the need for our economy and for a decent credit industry to have credit bureaus which have full records. And that is my real concern. So in one sense, I strongly support this clause because I think these bad records should be, the good responses and payments should be recorded. But you simply delete a bad record. And also in terms of criminal procedures, you can pull out if somebody has a criminal record. I mean, a friend of mine applied for a job. And then they said, but you've got a criminal record. He said, what for? Oh, well, when he was 20 at university, they ran naked across the street as a student prank, and he was arrested for public indecency, and he got a criminal record. Now, obviously, once they'd investigated the case, but the point is he had a criminal record. Now, I mean, it's that sort of kind of thing you want to remove from the credit bureau. So I really don't have a problem with the credit bureaus updating and being forced to update that the lady in Porfato and the lady in Makinta has paid her cut. So we can talk about it.
Thank you about that. Yes. I want to actually remind members, I actually made a point, and we spent, as you know, more than an hour over our own consultant's comments on this, an independent, who took account of Treasury, who took account of the South African Reserve Bank. And I draw you once again to her comments on 6, 7, and 8. I can see your hand, Honourable Salah, and I will take it. But she points out that in the end, you have to take account of the context of your own country. And it becomes a policy issue, and that there are points for and against. But what is required in legislation, and by us as legislators, is to balance these. And in fact, she goes further to say, in her view, this piece of legislation, Amendment Bill, attempts to strike a balance by providing for the removal of adverse classifications of consumer behavior here and adverse classifications of enforcement, while at the same time allowing for the retention of personal payment profiles. And I think it was when, Treasury and Saab heard that. I won't say that they gave us 5 stars or a platinum, but there was... You could hear a sigh of relief that came here. And then the issue became credit. What do you call it? Credit insurance. Honourable Salah, you want to have the last comment before me?
Jefferson, I think we have spent too much time on this matter. And I want to move that we adopt this clause.
All right. I have given an assurance that this will be done after tea. change that. It's going to have tea. It's amazing how a nice cup of hot tea cools all of us down.
You got it. Yeah. Oh, it's quite good. Now you see the tea. Well,
we want to see.
We want to publish.
But on the other hand, I am a
bank.
I'm
too much.
Now we've got a mess on the village. I know more to take.
Well, you can find that on the